But it was widely known that the U.S. was going to invade Afghanistan, so Richard Clark ain't telling you the truth. What else is he not telling you the truth about? He is enshrining the lies that need to be enshrined to keep a power structure greater than George W. Bush in power. This is from the BBC's George Arney. U.S. planned attack on Taliban. It was in place. He published this 18 September, but he documents that going back 6, 8 months, a year, well back into the Clinton administration before the attacks, the U.S. military had a plan to invade Afghanistan. What a surprise. Now, again, we talked about this last night, how you only need a few key people in place to control a covert operation like this. We had David Frasca. I did this last night, so I'm just going to pass over it real quick. But now we come to a quote from the U.S. Energy Policy. This is the Vice President Cheney's National Energy Policy Development Group, which concluded its work in May of 2001 in absolute secrecy, and which has to this day, in spite of several lawsuits and a very vigorous campaign by Congressman Henry Waxman of California, has refused to reveal its records from hearings that were paid for out of public money involving outside businesses. It's going to be a Supreme Court ruling this July, and I have said consistently since 9/11, the deepest, darkest secrets of 9/11, the motive for 9/11, lies in Vice President Cheney's Energy Task Force. Look at a couple of quotes. America in the year 2001 faces the most serious energy shortage since the oil embargoes of the 1970s. Estimates indicate that over the next 20 years, U.S. oil consumption will increase by 33%, natural gas consumption by well over 50%, and demand for electricity will rise by 45%. U.S. energy consumption is expected to increase by 32% by 2020. Between 2000 and 2020, U.S. natural gas demand is projected by the Energy Information Administration to increase by more than 50%. Yet we produce 39% less oil today than we did in 1970, the peak year of U.S. production, leaving us more reliant on foreign suppliers. On our present course, America 20 years from now will import nearly 2 of every 3 barrels of oil, a condition of increased dependency on foreign powers that do not always have America's best interests at heart, as if it was somehow their obligation to have our best interests at heart. Look, let's talk about peak oil quick, and I'm really tired of the debate. I'm really tired of there's no proof, there's no evidence. I'm not going to take time to go through this, but if we talk about peak oil real quickly, who's been talking about it? Foreign Affairs Magazine, James Kenneth Galbraith. This is the Sunday Morning Herald, The End of Oil, The Halifax Limited, The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. Now, there's a real group of conspiracy nuts. For immediate relief, oil shortages likely, this is Petroleum Review, they've done the math. The big oil shortages arrive in 2007. More oil analysis, Living Without Oil, U.S. News and World Report. David Goodstein, the Vice Chancellor of the California Institute of Technology, who has a great new book out talking about it. The Independent, Saudi Aramco, Nature, there's a real conspiracy rag. BBC News, The Los Angeles Times. I can do this for hours with the people who are talking about it. This is a story from ABC News, which talks about how serious, it says exactly what Richard Heinberg was just telling you. So as CNN said it, I can do the same thing with natural gas. So don't tell me it's not real. It's real. We've done the studies. We've done the analysis of the production numbers. The difference between natural gas and oil is that oil flows down a bell curve, so that you have to expend more energy as you go off the cliff to get lower quality, lesser quality oil. The light sweet crude's at the top, we drain the big fields, but now we've got to go deep, pump in steam, pump in water to get sour oil. Every barrel of oil becomes not only harder to find, it becomes more expensive to produce. Natural gas, it just blows until there's no more pressure, and we go off a cliff, and we're off the cliff. I predicted successfully 6 weeks before it happened, the blackout of last August 14th. How did I do that? Because I was watching natural gas numbers. They haven't built new infrastructure because there's no natural gas to power the plants. And I got a real nasty surprise for you Greens out there that's coming up. In his just released book, Out of Gas, this is from the Goodstein book, he writes, Goodstein argues forcefully that worldwide production of oil will peak soon, possibly within this decade. Clear evidence is showing that it peaked actually in 2000. As Saudi Arabia peaked. That would be followed by declining availability of fossil fuels that could plunge the world into global conflicts as nations struggle to capture their piece of a shrinking pie. I would ask you, does that bear any resemblance to the world we're living in today? Yeah. Now, the most important article I've written in the last 2 years is called In Your Face. It's a free story, and I used some work done by the brilliant Professor Michael Clare, who wrote a book called Resource Wars. He's a professor in New England, very widely recognized, where he dissected what was known out of the Energy Policy Task Force official report. And in his analysis, he said, clearly what they're saying is there's only so much oil, and if we're going to need X number of barrels, we have to take it away from somebody else. That's the bottom line. He has a great quote here. The Cheney report is very guarded about the amount of foreign oil that will be required. The only clue required by the public, provided by the public report, is a chart of net U.S. oil consumption and production over time. According to this illustration, domestic oil field production will decline from about 8.5 million barrels per day in 2002 to 7 million barrels a day in 2020, while consumption will jump from 19.5 million to 25.5 million barrels a day. That suggests imports of other sources will have to rise from 11 million to 18.5 million barrels a day. Most of the recommendations of the National Energy Policy Group are aimed at procuring the 7.5 million per day increment, equivalent to the total consumption, total oil consumed by China and India. We are at a place where if we take it from somebody else, we are literally taking it from somebody else. Some very interesting things surfaced out of this, and if you get nothing else out of what I say today, watch this map. 7 pages of records from the National Energy Policy Development Group were surfaced as a result of a FOIA, or Freedom of Information Act, suit filed by the Sierra Club. And some of those pages included maps. Now, this is not the map. I had people in my office take the maps, which are cut up. They're like a mosaic. And I had them assemble the oil field maps into what you see on the left of the screen. This is what they were talking about in Vice President Cheney's Energy Task Force, along with lists of who had development contracts that literally boiled down to, if we invade, who can we get to go along with us to form a coalition of the willing if we offer them a piece of the pie, and who absolutely cannot afford to endorse a U.S. invasion of the region. And that's exactly the way it played out. In other words, what they were discussing in May was a mirror of what happened after the Iraqi invasion. But here's a secret, and it's very chilling. This area right here is what was disclosed from the maps out of the National Energy Policy Development Group. If you were to take this triangle from way up here just north of Mosul, run through this part of Iran down here, and just expand it to there, down here, you have just circled 60% of all the recoverable oil on planet Earth. 60% of all the oil is in an area that fits easily into Texas. Well, wherever the pointer is. You see the triangle on Texas, okay? That's just a little bit larger than the state of Indiana. 6 out of every 10 barrels left remaining for this planet is there, but it takes 6 weeks to get a drop of oil from that region into an American gas tank. This is a map I did more than 2 years ago, before we invaded Iraq. Now, you see here, and again, this pointer is like fritzing on me, but Iraq is now invaded. Now, if you look at the military deployment around the region, and you go back and look at that map again, don't you see what we've done? Oops. We have absolutely encircled the oil. And that was the plan. That was the plan from December 11th. It is the plan that has been executed. Now, I have said clearly also that China is the end game from oil. I wrote this in From the Wilderness, my newsletter, probably about 18 to 20 months ago. This is a story from February of this year from the LA Times. What does it say? U.S. and China. China just passed Japan as the second largest oil importing nation on the planet. And their consumption is exploding. Chinese auto sales went up 100% in 1 year. And the rub is that Wall Street's financial markets will die if there is no market in China to buy computers, automobiles, factories, to take our jobs, to sell to the Chinese people. So we can't live with them and we can't live without them. But that's the end game. And it's becoming extremely clear, especially as China starts increasing military aid to West African nations. Look at this. And the scariest story we've ever published on From the Wilderness is called Eating Fossil Fuels. The world consumes 10 calories of hydrocarbon energy for every calorie of food that we eat. You take away the hydrocarbon energy, you take away the food. All fertilizers are made from natural gas. All pesticides are made from petroleum. All food crops are irrigated by electricity generated by burning natural gas or oil or coal. Some cases, atomic power. Some cases, small cases, hydroelectric. But China is already reaching a food crisis, and CNN's Lou Dobbs just a few months ago reported that the breadbasket of the world, the U.S. and Canada, will soon no longer be able to export grain. Why? Because our topsoil has become so eroded, it is like a sponge onto which we pour chemicals to grow food, and we ain't going to be able to feed the world anymore. Now, how do you think the world's going to feel about it if we're stealing all their natural resources and we're not even sending out grain anymore? This is a map I produced from Zbigniew Brzezinski's book, The Grand Chessboard. Published in 1997, and the broader circle, the outside one, because the pointer is not working now, but the outer circle from a map in 1997 was where Brzezinski said the next world conflict was going to occur. When I worked for LAPD, we called that a clue. It's a map we prepared it from the wilderness going to West Africa since 9/11. Every place you see a fire is a place where there has been an outbreak of terrorist or subversive activity. Everywhere you see an oil well, there's new oil development. Everywhere you see a green soldier is a place where U.S. Army Special Forces have been deployed since 9/11. Is that suspicious to you? Now, Africa is a drop in the bucket compared to, in terms of reserve numbers, compared to the Middle East. But the difference is this. It takes 6 weeks to get a drop of oil from the Persian Gulf into your gas tank. It takes 2 weeks to get a drop of oil from Nigeria into your gas tank. And isn't it strange that all the focus after the Spanish bombings is now moving toward Morocco? Duh, right here. Well, there's the pointer not working again. There it is. Morocco up on the upper west coast of Africa, where Kerr McGee, Halliburton, and oil companies have just secured major new leases for smaller fields to develop. Terrorism goes exactly where the oil is. That's the map I've been following for 2 years, and it's why I've been able to be so far ahead. I'm just following the oil. London Times, America keen to exploit boom in Africa's black gold. Voice of America, there's a fine nonpartisan outfit funded by the CIA. But look at a story that they produced here last May of 2003. U.S. NATO allies may focus on Africa, predicts NATO's senior military commander, General James Jones, with that goofy look on his face there, has announced that NATO is shifting its focus to West Africa. That's right before the U.S. Navy gave Nigeria 6 U.S. warships. So I was writing a year and a half ago, hey, we're going to West Africa to fight. And now we come to Haiti. Here's a map. See, Haiti's up there on the left of the island of Hispaniola right there. That's Florida up there. You see, look at the fact that Haiti is an exact midpoint between the southern coast of Florida and Venezuela. We can't invade Venezuela unless we control the whole island. Yeah, we have military bases in Puerto Rico, some in the Dominican Republic, but the U.S. would never engage in a military occupation with an indigenous Latin American or French population that's hostile to U.S. interests next to Cuba behind the supply lines to invade Venezuela. That is why immediately after we had the coup d'etat in Venezuela, Hugo Chavez said, hey, baby, Chavez is not Aristide and Venezuela is not Haiti. If Bush, he called Bush an asshole, as quoted by Reuters. And Hugo Chavez, El Zorro, as they call him, said, if America makes one move to Venezuela, I'll shut off their oil immediately. Now, you take that oil away from the United States, then the U.S. economy collapses. There's no elasticity. It's not a matter of how much oil you take out. It's the fact that if you take out, you know, an ounce out of a system that's already at capacity, the whole system collapses. And I don't think I had time to put the slide in here because just a few days ago before I came up, there was a story from the Venezuelan Times how the Chinese government was in Venezuela negotiating to buy all of Venezuela's oil. Now, if I really want to offend you, I came back from the Peak Oil Conference, the second Peak Oil Conference in Paris last May, and I had reported out of that, number one, that Saudi Arabian reserves had probably peaked. I spoke with Ali Samsam Bakhtiari, who was the vice president of the Iranian National Oil Company. By the way, Iran peaked in 1987. You know that Iran is importing gasoline now? And I reported that he had said that Saudi reserves had peaked several months before the New York Times reported it just about a month ago or less than a month. I said that Matthew Simmons, the world's largest energy investment banker, had suggested that Saudi Arabia had peaked. But I came back from Paris and I said, and we said, and I wasn't the only one to conclude this, that America's knee-jerk reaction in the face of peak oil would be two things. It would be to revert to coal and nuclear. Now, nobody even knows this. And I'm running through the Christian Science Monitor the other day, and I see this story. This is a story from February 26, not too long ago. And it says right here that the United States has now started construction of 93 new coal-fired nuclear power plants, coal-fired power plants. Coal. You know the stuff, greenhouse gas, the stuff that kills us, the stuff that does global warming? And in Paris, we had this dialogue with a very nice guy, I'm trying to remember his name, from the Global Commons Institute, who was a very big green activist, and he had admitted that peak oil would probably kill us before greenhouse gases do, and then we both said, unless the United States reverts to coal, which is the only energy we can get. Now, it's so under the radar. Kyoto, we never signed anyway. All the environmental laws are out. 93 new coal-fired plants pumping carbon dioxide directly into the atmosphere. And they're already being built. Why? Dick Cheney told you, the American way of life is not negotiable. And we will commit suicide. We will commit global human suicide the way species commit suicide as a result of over-adaptation because we will not negotiate our standards of consumption. James Kenneth Galbraith, and I'm going to read these quotes and they're very important. Maybe I should just cut off there. James Kenneth Galbraith, you know, is the son of John Galbraith, an incredible economist. Let me read you what he wrote in November of 2002. The real economic cost of Bush's empire building is twofold. It diverts attention from pressing economic problems at home, and it sets the United States on a long-term imperial path that is economically ruinous. Nor is Bush's strategy necessarily irrational insofar as it affects oil in the short run. With a new Iraqi government, the United States will gain a client state that is prepared to help keep the oil price within the band that both the U.S. consumers and the remaining U.S. oil producers can tolerate. Notice he said remaining. They're dropping out. There's no more oil. Low enough so as not to fatally drain purchasing power from the former, high enough so as not to immediately ruin the latter. Given the George W. Bush, Dick Cheney commitment to unlimited oil consumption, this will prove useful in putting off a day of reckoning. As total world oil production declines, credible scientific evidence suggests that this may start happening quite soon. The Middle East share of the remaining reserves will rise. So too would the potential for cartel control and price manipulation. A robust U.S. military presence in the oil fields directly or by proxy will naturally make higher oil prices less of a danger. This is part of the appeal of the war with Iraq. First, private business investment in the United States has fallen virtually to the capital replacement level. That's called life support when you're speaking economically. Second, the recession in consumer spending cannot be put off forever. American households are still being crushed by debt. Third, state and local government budgets continue to implode. Reasonable estimates now show $50 billion in deficits at the state level, and the losses are surely almost as large at the local level. Fourth, we have economic effects of the decline of our financial markets, which have already lost more than $8 trillion in nominal shareholder value since their peak in 2000. To some extent, these losses are due to the corruption of certain major corporations, including several, not least Halliburton, that are closely tied to the military petroleum complex. It is a straightforward fact that if global oil production starts to decline, but U.S. consumption does not, everyone else will be required to cut purchases and uses of oil. But how can oil prices be held stable for Americans, yet made to rise for everybody else? Only by a policy of continuing depreciation in everyone else's currency. Such a policy of dollar hegemony and amid worldwide financial instability, of crushing debt burdens and deflation throughout the developing world is perverse. Meanwhile, we will not experience even a gradual exposure, as Richard was talking about, as I have written about extensively at From the Wilderness, we published many stories on alternative energy, will not experience even a gradual exposure to the changing energy balance. We will therefore never make the investments required to adjust, even eventually, to a world of scarce and expensive oil. In the end, therefore, that world will arrive much more abruptly than it otherwise would, shaking the fragile edifice of our oil economy to its foundations, and we will someday face a double explosion of anger against our arrogance and of actual shortage and collapsing living standards when the confidence of investors in the dollar finally gives way. That is a recipe for disaster. That is the recipe that we are following on this roadmap. My job with 9/11, of course, is to describe to you the plane crash, the train wreck, the disaster, the Holocaust, the Armageddon that just occurred. But while everybody's focusing over the carcass of 9/11, somebody's got to look up and say, there's another one coming. And it's here. It's here now. M. King Hubbard, who was the first pioneer to tell us about peak oil, who has been vindicated and validated so many times over the years, wrote so succinctly in his first book. He said, until you change the way money works, you will change nothing. In Paris, this is where my dear friend Catherine Austin Fitz comes in. I love her to pieces. In Paris, a senior, mega, powerful Dutch economist came up and took the podium at the peak oil conference at the L'Institut du Pétrole Français, the French Institute of Petroleum, and said with all seriousness, it may not be profitable to slow the effects of decline. In English, that means is they can find no way of making money by saving human life and averting famine, disaster, war, and Armageddon. And if they can't find a way to make money, they won't do it. That's the world we live in. These are the choices we have to face. So as we play this game of 9/11, we must truly understand what the stakes are that we are facing, not as a country, not as not as anything else but a species. To quote Richard Colin Campbell, my good friend who founded, the species of Homo sapiens may not become extinct, although it may, but the subspecies of petroleum man most certainly will. Now, the question is, do we want to do it nice or do we want to do it nasty? The world has chosen to embark on a path that is the worst Nazi nightmare ever seen. It will be bloody, it will be violent, it will involve population reduction by the most brutal, venal, underhanded methods. So ultimately, what I have to say to you is that as I look at this and as I've studied this and as I've worked 26 years to unravel this covert mechanism that governs our lives, I'm firmly convinced that what we are now faced with is a choice offered to us by our Creator. Either evolve or perish. Thank you.
That was Mike Rupert of From the Wilderness. For more on his work, visit his website, copvcia.com. That's COPVCIA. copvcia.com. TUC's Mariah Gallardon will introduce our final speaker.
Next up is Daniel Hotziker. He is an investigative journalist and author of Welcome to Terrorland. He also is the producer of the amazing video, the Muhammad Atta and the Flying Circus video. His presentation includes a 10-minute interview with Muhammad Atta's girlfriend, which will help us with his presentation to understand the enigma of Muhammad Atta. Who was this guy? So that's the topic for Daniel Hotziker. Please welcome him.
Hey, how's everybody doing?
Well, I'm going to start by giving you 60 seconds on me, and probably the first thing to say is that I was in perfect health till I got on a plane in Boston yesterday to come here, flew 10 hours and had a sore throat, and now I'm all clammy, you know? But in terms of telling you who I am, being in Boston, I was in Boston meeting with attorneys because I'm being sued currently for the second time for the first book I wrote, Barry and the Boys, the CIA, the Mob, and American Secret History. The man that's suing me currently for emotional distress was the consigliere, the attorney, to the biggest drug smuggler in American history, Barry Seal, for a dozen years. When Barry Seal was assassinated in 1986 on orders of then Vice President George Bush, by a Colombian hit team, eight-man Colombian hit team directed while they were in this country by a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Military by the name of Oliver North. Michael Ray Fugle went on to an illustrious career. He's currently in business with Adnan Khashoggi, and he's suing me. So we'll see. But it's kind of a backhanded compliment. I don't get publicity here in the U.S., so at least when they sue me, I know they know I'm there, which is, you know, small consolation, but then small consolation is better than none. My story starts here, right outside here in Walnut Creek, California. I went to my last 2 years of high school. I'm going to give you 60 seconds on me, because then when I tell you what I have discovered down in Venice, Florida about Muhammad Atta, which is who I'm here to talk about, you'll have a better idea of how to judge what I'm saying. You know, is he, you know, full of shit, or who is he? I went to high school in the Bay Area. It was the best. I'm from the Midwest, but last 2 years of high school, I got gassed, tear gassed at People's Park. I was 15 years old at the time. When I got ready to go to college, my dad said, I wanted to go to Berkeley, and my dad said, well, you can go to Berkeley, son, but I won't pay for it. And I said, well, why not, Dad? And he said, because if you go to Berkeley, you're going to end up in jail. So he said, probably the only true thing the man ever said. I mean, I love my dad. You know, he's dead now. But so I went to UCLA. I did end up in jail during my junior year at UCLA. See, if you're from the Bay Area and you're at UCLA, you know how to do stuff people down there don't. So during my third year, I was a junior, and I led this student strike. I believe it was because Henry Kissinger was carpet bombing North Vietnam at Christmas. And I was arrested afterwards on 19 separate misdemeanor counts. 4 counts of inciting a riot, 4 counts of participating in a riot, 2 counts of failure to leave the campus after the chancellor has ordered you to, and a couple counts of disorderly conduct. And that, in early 1972, was the end of my political career until 4 or 5 years ago. When I was arrested, the police officers in Los Angeles, and Mike Gruber, if he's here, will know about this, they took me down to the Hollenbeck Division to threw me in the drunk tank. I spent a night in the drunk tank, I mean, just like on pallets with just vomit everywhere, and I decided that my political career was about at an end. You know, I mean, it doesn't take a lap. I did what I could. And then I went on with my life. And thank God the Vietnam War ended, you know, before it turned into a 100 years war. I became because my dad made me go to LA, I became a TV producer. Had you know, a career you'd have never heard of me, ever. I was a business news producer 5 years ago, 6 years ago now. I had a business show airing on internationally on NBC. I went out to produce a pilot for a second series. I was going to update a silly show called In Search Of, da-da-da-da, extraterrestrials, Pyramid of Mars cover-ups. I was, like, totally ready to update that. It's still in reruns. And the story my associate producers sold me on featuring on the pilot episode involved 2 17-year-old high school seniors who are walking down train tracks in Arkansas, larking on an August midnight in 1987 when they're murdered when they stumble onto a drug drop. Well, I'll tell you, people all over the country think we're weird from California, but you know, I was happy to tell them in Arkansas we had never heard of a drug drop, you know, a place where literally drugs rain from the sky and or money in duffel bags. I mean, I said if we had heard of it, you know, we'd be out there like this. long story short, that 15-minute feature on a half-hour pilot became a 2-hour TV special called The Secret Heartbeat of America about allegations that the CIA controlled and directed the cocaine trafficking in the 1980s in support of George Bush's and Bill Casey's Contra War. I turned it into my big dog friend in Hollywood, who's a big guy, he's a big producer, manages Robin Williams, Billy Crystal, and likes me enough to have told me the truth when I came back 3 days and said, hey, this isn't going to air. And I said, what do you mean it's not going to air? I'm $100,000 upside down in this. And he said, it's not. And, you know, that's from the Midwest. You know, I'm basically a naive person. So at that point, I decided I was going to do a book about this son of a gun that I couldn't get a TV show, a documentary up on, and his name is Barry Seal, and this is that book. And I just want to reference the cover. You probably can't see it here. I spent 2 years living with Barry Seal's widow, typical CIA widow, did not know much about what her husband did, except he did smuggle drugs, she knew that. And I had access to his files, which had been already cleaned out by a 7-man team from the State Department 5 years earlier. There were 4 bestsellers written about Barry Seal before I got there. Mine was not a bestseller. In fact, I got sued just before the book came out and kept it from reaching bookstores. But what I discovered about Barry Seal, fine writers before me, no one had seemed to ask or answer the question, who was this guy before he became the biggest, by the government's own words, the biggest drug smuggler in American history, brought 5 tons of cocaine into the U.S. during the 1980s. Who was he before that? Did he just get lucky? And it turned out Barry Seal was a lifelong CIA agent. flew with the Bay of Pigs, flew a getaway plane after the Kennedy assassination, was active in Central America on Operation Condor, all before he became, was involved in Watergate. So when September 11th happened, that's enough on me. When September 11th happened, I was waiting in Louisiana for my book to come out. And 2 days after September 11th, it came out on the news, but very sotto voce, very like low key, that not just both of the pilots that took down the World Trade Center, but a third pilot, Siad El-Jarrah, at the controls of the plane that crashed in Western Pennsylvania, had all learned to fly at the tiny Venice, Florida airport. And I said, that's hinky. My parents have had a winter house in Venice, Florida since 1975. Venice, Florida has the second oldest population in the entire United States. The average age is 69. Before I ever went to Venice, I was asking myself, why would a 30-year-old, even if he is a terrorist, a bunch of them, choose to spend the last year of their life in a retirement community? Would you? There's 220 flight schools in Florida alone. Why did they both choose? Why did three of the four choose? Two at the tiny Venice, Florida airport. So I get to Venice, Florida, and to give you a little, discovered that the two flight schools at Venice, Florida airport had each been sold in the year before the terrorists began to arrive in dozens and dozens and dozens by two separate Dutch nationals. And because of Barry and the boys, I had met some interesting people, and I called this famous Southern lawman, who I like, although he's been on the wrong side of more issues than not. And I asked him, I told him, both these flight schools that the terrorists went to were owned by Dutch boys that had bought the schools just before the terrorists began showing up. What do you think of that? And he drawled, he said, two Dutch boys is one damn Dutch boy too many. He said, it's untidy. So I moved to Venice, which was nice. I mean, you know, not that y'all care, but I haven't lived in the same town as my mom and dad since I was 18, and it was, you know, I play cards with them late at, you know, at night. There's nothing else to do. First thing that happened when I got to Venice was I was pulled over by the Venice police twice in the first day I was there. And in the 25 years that I've been visiting my mom and dad, I'd go down there for 4 or 5 days every winter, and in the 25 years I've been doing that, I'd never seen a cop. But I pulled over twice, and no tickets, no anything, just, you know, meet and greet. So I told the second guy, I said, well, you know, do you think it might be a good idea if I checked in with the chief of police? And he allowed that it could. So I went down, and I'm glad I did. I went down to meet the chief of police, and he wasn't available to meet me, but his sergeant and chief spokesman was. And I took the occasion to ask the sergeant and chief spokesman if he could tell me about any of Rudy Dekker's priors. The Dutch boy, one of the magic Dutch boys, Rudy Dekkers, had been on every television show known to man in the days after the September 11th attack, and probably is singly most instrumental in establishing what has become the official story about who the hijackers were while they were in this country. He was on every show. He was on Greta Van Susteren. He was on Larry King. He was on, Dan Rather, Peter Jennings, you name it. He was there, and he was talking his ass off, and he was lying through his teeth, but nobody knew it. Nobody knew it. When I discovered that Rudy Dekkers, who established who Muhammad Atta had been, and when he had been in Venice, when I discovered that Rudy Dekkers is a criminal, wanted in his native Holland, he can't go home because he goes to jail, I asked myself, why is it Dan Rather didn't know this before putting him on? Why didn't Larry King know this, or the CBS evening, you know, morning news? I mean, you know, don't they do due diligence? No, they don't. So, I did a documentary after I was there for 6 months called Muhammad Atta, the Venice Flying Circus, and then spent another year researching, and the book is Welcome to Terrorland, Muhammad Atta, and the 9/11 cover-up in Florida. And that's what I'm going to talk to you about. We're going to see a little clip, but first I'm going to tell you I have three hard things to do here. Okay? Three hard things to do. Three things to tell y'all that some of you may not be comfortable with, which is why I want to tell you who I was before I got to that. So, although there are a dozen burning questions about 9/11 worthy of book-length investigation, we chose to focus on just one. Muhammad Atta in Florida, who, what, when, where, why. I did it because I did not believe the government was telling me the truth about who had killed those people. And the only reason I'm talking to you now, the only reason I wrote this book, the only reason I did the documentary, the only reason I investigated it is because I am interested in bringing every son of a bitch responsible for those 3,000 people I saw die to justice. And imagine my surprise when I discovered that they don't all have Arab names. My investigation strategy was this. I was down there. I listened to a friend's cynical dictum that the only real news you get when something major happens is in the first 24, 48 hours before they get the cover-up in place. So the first thing I did when I got to Venice, Florida, not the first thing, but, you know, I mean, after I'd talked to the cops, I haven't finished telling you that. Okay, I'm, you know, I got to go back to that. So I meet this sheriff in town, you know, and he knows, who, you know, we're okay. We're okay. I can drive around town. I can go out to the airport. I can do anything I want. And so I take the occasion to ask him, does Rudy Deckers have any priors? And he looks at me with the saddest expression on his face. I could not believe it. He said, I would like to tell you that. He said, but I can't. And I said, well, why can't you? And he said, because the day after September 11th, the FBI came in and confiscated all our files having anything to do with September 11th and loaded them into two Ryder trucks right outside this window here and drove them up to Sarasota Airport, where they were driven onto a C-130 and flown to Washington, D.C. with Jeb Bush aboard. Now, it would have been one thing if the FBI had copied the relevant files, but they didn't. They confiscated them, and I'm here to tell you that after spending 2 years where the FBI's primary investigation was supposed to be, their 4,000-man team, I can tell you that all I saw that the FBI did was confiscate evidence and intimidate witnesses. There are a lot of people in Florida, and if you think about it, other places too, with what's known as inconvenient knowledge, eyewitnesses to the terrorist conspiracies, movements, and activities while they were in these United States. And I interviewed a lot of what historians call primary sources, eyewitnesses. And the thing I'm about to show you a clip from, the thing I'm proudest of, I found in the news clips a half a dozen local stories about Muhammad Atta's American girlfriend, a girl named Amanda Keller. And before she disappeared, she said only 11 words to reporters down there. I can't really say anything, she said. I'm afraid I'll get in trouble. And I went looking for her because obviously she is someone that could tell you what she saw. And it took me 6 months to find her, which is the thing I'm proudest of. I did find her. By the time I found her, it was a year after September 11th. She got a visit every week for 6 months, as did several other eyewitnesses I'm going to tell you about, from an FBI agent, not the same FBI agent, so it's not like you can blame this on a few bad apples. And the FBI agent was interested in only one thing. You haven't been talking to anybody, have you? So there it was in the newspaper. I mean, in the New York Times-owned local newspaper, that Muhammad Atta had an American girlfriend. And you know what? She's a stripper, she was. She was a lingerie model. She had pink hair, all right? And I'm thinking, you know, this is a year afterwards I discovered this. I found her a year later. And I'm going, geez, if it took me a year to find her, it would have taken the National Enquirer 2 days, 10 days. You know, and what about, you know, terrorist girlfriend bears all. I saw a side of Muhammad no one else saw, says stripper girlfriend. Right? I mean, you know, why haven't we seen that story? Well, you know what? That story just came out in a Berlin Daily, and I'm proud of this, the day before yesterday. They didn't review my book, but they took stuff right out of it. And this is exactly what I thought the National Enquirer would have printed. It's a picture of Amanda, a picture of Atta, and they're having some kind of kinky sex they're talking about. But you know, and it is an illustration of how massive the cover-up has been in this country that you haven't heard that Muhammad Atta had a girlfriend. He had a next-door neighbor. They all did. How many eyewitness accounts about these people have you read? So damn few. So let me tell you a minute about what a primary source is. I recorded the, you know, with videotape, because I'm a TV producer, too. But I just wanted it for documentation. I did a 3.5-hour interview, just turned the camera on, talked to her, and I'll show you 5 minutes of it. But as you're watching, you know, 5 minutes of it, think about what we're learning from this, okay? This is just a girl telling her story, and she's obviously not the sharpest knife in the drawer, although she's cleaned up her act. I'm not going to tell you her story, but she's sober today, and she has 3 children, and she's 22, which is a very common story in Florida, okay? Very common story in Florida. So as we watch 5 minutes of this, think about what we're learning about Muhammad Atta just through listening to her talk. Okay, you can roll the tape.
And that was when they introduced me to everybody in the apartment. That was the first time I went over there. And that's when I met Angelina and Olivia and the big Dutch guy, but I can't remember what his name is for the life of me, but he's huge. He's like 7 feet tall. He's monstrous. I can't remember his name. he was a friend of Olivia's, and he had lived at that apartment with them. And Peter, Stefan, Timothy, and this is when I met Timothy, too. And I already met Jurgen. I had seen Timothy, but I was never actually talked to him, you know. And there was some other guy that lived there, and he had dark hair, and he looked kind of like Muhammad, but he was like, he had real long hair. And he said he was from France. He was real quiet and like moody, you know. He just didn't talk to him. Did not talk to him. And they were always drinking. There wasn't wine, it was beer or liquor or whatever. They was always drinking. Always.
So once you met everyone there, okay, they started doing drugs in front of you?
Yeah, I guess because they considered themselves to be comfortable around me. I don't know. They pulled out coke and
You saw Muhammad doing coke?
Yeah. They borrowed $1 from me to do it. And they asked me if I wanted to do it.
Where was this?
That was at the Sentinel apartment.
Okay.
There was a glass table that they used to cut it on. And they asked me if I wanted to do it. No. You know, that was movie shit.
Right.
You know, the first time I had ever seen it was in the movie that's from The Doors.
Right.
You know? So that was movie stuff. I'm like, no.
So when did Muhammad ask you to get an apartment with him? How long had you been back from Key West? I'll bet it wasn't
three
long.
Days.
Yeah, I figured it wasn't long.
2 or 3 days, uh-huh. Maybe.
Uh-huh. And how did he say it?
He asked me if I would find an apartment to split rent with him.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Whatever. I wanted an out from Robert.
Right.
So he was like open opportunity for me to run and never look back. And so we went to, I found Sandpiper apartments. I was the one that looked for those.
Right.
And at first I had found these little dinky apartments. Tampico Bay is the nursing home that I worked at right behind there.
Mm-hmm.
I was still working for Papa John's at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Tampico Bay is right behind there. And when there's a little side street that goes like this between the apartments, and there's like a little, I didn't know they were efficiencies, but because they said apartment in the paper, and I went there and I'm like, you know, so I found Sandpiper and I met Charlie and I thought he was really nice. I liked Charlie a lot. And we went in there and I filled out the paperwork and I talked him into, he used the check to pay for the apartment, and the check that he used was in the name Muhammad, and I thought the last name on there was that A-R-A-J-A-K-I or whatever it was, but I only seen an A. I don't know, maybe, because they found bank accounts. I know they told me they found bank accounts all over the place that he had, you know, in different names and stuff. And his bank account was on Venice Island. His bank was on Venice. And it was key things that happened at the apartment. There were dirty dishes in the sink. And he was like, aren't you going to do the dishes? He made the mess. I'm like, you made the mess? You effing clean it up. He was like, that's your role. And I said, no. You're in America. My name's the primary name on the lease. I said, you're nowhere on there. I was like, this is my house. Because I talked him into using his money to get the apartment.
Okay.
You know?
So you guys, I mean, you weren't to die for in love with him, you know, by any means.
I could barely stand him. I was just using him. He did have some good points. I mean, like when I first met him, he was, you know, he knew exactly what to say to me because I guess he could see sin, because I was like afraid to, because, you know.
You met Garrett. Where did you meet Garrett?
Margarita Maggie's, and Muhammad was there that night.
Oh, really? Where's Margarita Maggie's?
In Sarasota.
Okay.
In the Quay, like near the Quay.
Gotcha.
Okay, it's near that area.
All right, so you're at Margarita Maggie's with who? With Muhammad.
Angelina, Olivia, Timothy, Jurgen, Sabrina, Muhammad, Volskin, all of them were there. All of them. And Muhammad's dumbass was standing up on a speaker and embarrassed me instantly when we got there, you know. And I was just pretending like I didn't even know him.
Wouldn't you like to hear more of that? I only have 10 minutes left, all right? So I got to... What we learned there, one of the things we learned is that Muhammad Atta hung out with guys not named Muhammad. Or Ahmet, or, you know, been something, okay? I mean, a lot of her stories began with, when she met him. Peter, Stefan, and Jurgen came in with Muhammad, you know, and then they all sat down. She went to Key West for a wild three-day weekend with Peter, Stefan, and Linda, a stripper, and two Germans flew in specifically to meet Mohammed Atta in a light plane, and who knows any of this yet. So I'm here to tell you, folks, that the basic investigation has not been done. I mean, I was in Venice, Florida, which is, I have told you, is the biggest September 11th crime scene. It wasn't reduced to rubble, and I was there alone. And this could have been done, I mean, you know, the people all over, but there. I wrote a book about two things. I'm going to read you the first line of the book, and then I'm going to explain it. I may not get too much further than that, but 14 of the 19 hijackers lived in Florida while they were in the U.S. 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis. So the story of the terrorist conspiracy that took down the World Trade Center is, perforce, a story about Saudis in Florida. Say that with me. Saudis in Florida. Not just Saudis, you know, but Saudis in Florida. Home of Jeb Bush, home of Catherine Harris. What I discovered in a nutshell is that beginning in 1999, literally hundreds of Arabs came to Southwest Florida to learn to fly. Between Naples on the south and Tampa on the north, there are three or four pilot openings every year in the Middle East. And all of a sudden, there are hundreds of Arabs coming to learn to fly. So the first line of my book is, this is the story of Mohammed Atta, a black-hearted psychopath in Florida, a pirate's paradise. If either had been different, September 11th might never have happened. And let's talk about Florida for a second. First, we couldn't count the votes. Now we're hosting terrorists, said one state lawmaker. My God, Florida's always involved in these things, said Oscar Westerfield, a retired FBI official. After the attack, Governor Bush defended the flight schools as victims of fanatics. Bob Graham, senator from Florida, I can't believe he must have known he was retiring. He said, Florida itself is a significant crossroads of international intrigue and clandestine connection. So there's a lot to discover in Florida about the Saudis who were doing business there. And there's a lot to discover about Mohammed Atta, and I'm going to tell you a little about Mohammed Atta, and I'm going to give you quickly, I guess, because I only have a few minutes, my three uncomfortable truths. Mohammed Atta was a psychopath. Mohammed Atta hated Americans. You saw a little of Amanda? She met this hot new guy, Gary. She didn't care for Mohammed Atta. He helped her get away from a guy that was beating her up, an abusive relationship. If Mohammed Atta hadn't become infamous, she'd have never thought of him again. But she met this hot new guy. She brought him home. Hot new guy was sleeping over. Hot new guy's in the big bed. Atta's on the couch. After discussing what she should do with the apartment house manager, Amanda unceremoniously dumped Atta's three suitcases and Gold's gym bag onto the parking lot underneath her second floor apartment and called him a cab. He told me he'd get even with me, she says. He said, you will be sorry for this. 1 week later, she found out what he meant. Upon returning from a long night at the escort service, the apartment that was now hers alone. Amanda kept a pet dog and several cats as well, one of whom had just had a litter, she informed us haltingly. There were six adorable kittens. But when she opened the door to her apartment, she didn't hear any kitten noises, which was strange. And then she hit the overhead light. Voice cracking with emotion, she told us what she saw. There were dead kittens, no, pieces of dead kittens, kitten parts strewn all over her living room. We asked her to repeat what she was saying, mainly because we couldn't believe what we were hearing. The mother cat had a litter of six, only one survived. The mother cat was dead, gutted on the kitchen table, on my kitchen table, and there were little baby cat parts all over the place. There were dead kittens with their heads cut off. I saw little baby legs and everything. It was awful. So I had two questions, and I didn't get to read you my two questions, but when I got to Florida for my investigation, I had two questions. Why Atta? Why Florida? I've given you just briefly a few reasons why Florida. There's a zillion more, but now I can tell you, I know why Atta. Why was Atta chosen to commit one of history's most unspeakable crimes? It was because he could. He was capable of it. Not merely capable, he was seemingly perfect for the job. Mohammed Atta was a psychopath, a kitten killer. We're in Jeffrey Dahmer territory here. I'm interested in finding who killed those people. Thank you. I got 10 minutes. And there are productive areas of investigation, and I believe unproductive areas of investigation. And I believe a productive area of investigation is pursuing who the terrorists were doing business with while they were in this country, okay? And I believe an unproductive area is anything that doesn't have to do with people hanging out of windows on the 110th floor. Mohammed Atta drove that plane into Flight 11, into the World Trade Center. And if any of y'all believe that it was done by remote control, don't come talking to me. I'm serious. Because, and I'm not saying this because I'm always right. Okay, I am always right. But I'm not. I mean, this is not, believe me, strictly an ego thing. If we get into ideas like reptoids on the backside of the moon, you know, blowing up the World Trade Center, like, by remote control with their minds, we're never going to find the people that are out there, and I know who some of them are that are responsible for this. All right, I'm not going to have time for uncomfortable truth number two. I'm glad. No, I do. I got to tell you this. All right, look, I want to tell you something. I yield to nobody here in my distaste for President George W. Bush. Are we clear about that? And I believe George W. Bush is responsible for September 11th, just not in the way a lot of you think, okay? But one of the first things I discovered, was that 2 hours before terrorist hijackers began crashing airliners into the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center, four Arab men in a white van pulled up to the guard gate of the hotel where George W. Bush was spending the night, the Colony Beach Resort Hotel in Longboat Key in Sarasota, and launched an attempt to assassinate the President of the United States. Boy, you could have. I mean, I could not have found anything more shocking, okay? And how I found it, I mean, judge for yourself, read the chapter. I discovered, once again, that cynical dictum, read the clips. I read the clips. An ABC News reporter reported that there had been a warning given of a threat to George W. Bush's life in the middle of the night before the morning of September 11th, taken seriously enough by the Secret Service to have raided a half a dozen apartments and houses in Sarasota, where they took into custody a dozen Sudanese nationals, who they later released. And they said that the warning was, they told the ABC reporter the warning was coincidental to anything that happened September 11th. Well, you know, I mean, Sarasota is like Hillsborough here, right? I mean, a dozen Sudanese nationals in white-bred Sarasota, Florida, home of Catherine Harris, were up to no good. God knows what they were doing. So that was half the story. The other half of the story was in the local Sarasota newspaper, the Longboat Observer. A Longboat fire captain, as a perk of his job, was waiting in the lobby at 6 a.m. that morning to go jogging with George W. Bush. And God bless local people. The only real good news I got down there were from local cops. Local people, they don't know enough to keep their mouths shut. They talk. They tell you what they saw. He saw the van pull up with four Arab men. The four Arab men told the Secret Service agent at the guard station that they were a film crew, TV crew, and they had an interview with George W. Bush set up at the pool after his jog, and they gave the name of Secret Service agent. The Secret Service agent at the guard gate turned them away because he couldn't clear it. Well, the Longboat Observer reporter, God bless him, that wrote up the story, happened to notice that that same ruse had been used successfully 2 days earlier, September 9th, to assassinate the Taliban's biggest foe, Shah Massoud. So, putting it all together, I had no choice but to conclude that somebody tried to kill George W. Bush the morning of September 11th, and I wondered, why don't we know that? I mean, I would have thought George W. Bush would have been screaming about that, you know? He doesn't have a military record to boast about, you know, that when we finally reached the fire captain by phone, Carol Mooneyhan, the man who saw the launch of a quickly hushed up assassination attempt on the life of George W. Bush, told us, I was visited by the CIA and the Secret Service after 9/11. I have a career to think about. I have to be careful what I say. And that was the last we heard from him. And the next chapter, which starts the rest of the book, begins, if people with careers to think about were being pressured into keeping silent about something as serious as an assassination attempt on the president, what else might authorities be covering up? Try almost anything, and then delete almost. Well, I got 2 out of 3 in. I have to tell you, a lot of people have been focused on the macro. I'm a reporter down there. I'm an investigative reporter. I'm knocking on doors. Did you know Muhammad Atta? What did you see? And I'm writing it down, and I put it in the book. And you can draw your own conclusions. I can't tell you. I still know that I know what happened. But I know that 7 of Muhammad Atta's closest associates in the last year of his life in Florida were not Arab, but German and Swiss. And I know their names. And I know that Muhammad Atta did cocaine regularly and drank every night. Now, you ever met an Islamic fundamentalist that does coke and shacks up with a pink-haired stripper? It's not funny, people. Because we have to ask ourselves now, if he's not an Islamic fundamentalist, who is he? Well, let's try Arab spy. Do spies smuggle drugs? 2 points and I'm done. Good, 2 points and I'm done. Thank you for your time, too. Point number one, In the same month that Mohammed Atta and Marwan al-Shehhi arrived, July of 2000, ostensibly by the FBI, arrived to begin flight training at Huffman Aviation, the true owner of Huffman Aviation, Wallace J. Hilliard, had his Learjet confiscated on the runway of Orlando Executive Airport by DEA agents brandishing submachine guns, who discovered 43 pounds of heroin on board. That's H-E-R-O-I-N. 2 minutes. I shouldn't have spelled it. Before September 11th, my understanding is Osama bin Laden ran Afghanistan. Before September 11th, my understanding is Afghanistan produced only one commodity that the world is interested in. I understand that that commodity is opium and or heroin. So my understanding is before September 11th, Osama bin Laden was the head of the world's first Islamic drug cartel. He was the heroin king. Now, ask yourself, if you're the heroin king, are you going to want to sell your product into the world's richest market in the United States? I'll bet you do. I know I would. Somebody was doing business with Osama bin Laden here in the United States, buying his heroin. The typical deal is oil and guns for oil and heroin for guns and training. Oil and heroin for guns and training. And they don't want you to know that. They don't want you to ask who was Osama, who was Mohammed. Mohammed Atta was a lieutenant in a drug cartel. He had 6 pilot's licenses when he arrived in the U.S. Who was he doing business with? Who was he selling the heroin to? Because if you find that person, you find someone that is complicit in the conspiracy. Because if you're performing, even if you didn't know, if you're performing an illegal act with a conspiracy that murders 3,000 people, you yourself are guilty of that murder. Hey, I'm done. Thank you for your time.
Daniel Hopsicker, author of Barry and the Boys.
You've been listening to recordings from the International Inquiry on the Unanswered Questions of 9/11, a grassroots effort to ask and answer questions regarding the 2001 suicide attacks that the government has demonstrated it is unwilling to address. For more info on the inquiry, which continues, visit on the web 911inquiry.org. 911inquiry.org. Many thanks to Mariah Gallardon of TUC Radio, who was responsible for all of the recordings heard in tonight's program. To learn more about and to support this dedicated community radio journalist, visit tucradio.org. tucradio.org. Tapes of the material you just heard are also available there as well. And to contact this program, Unwelcome Guests, visit our site, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by